KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, ignited a controversy with recent remarks about the American Civil War made during an interview with Fox News.
The lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War, and men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand where their conscience had them make their stand.
Kelly also called Confederate General Robert E. Lee an honorable man, and Civil War historians have refuted Kelly's account, with one Columbia University professor calling it the Jim Crow version of the causes of the Civil War. In the hour ahead, Forum discusses the history of the Civil War, how it is taught in schools, and why it remains such a polarizing topic. That's next after the news. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Welcome to this morning's program. President Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, made controversial remarks on Fox News recently in talking about the Civil War.
I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days.
Kelly said the Civil War was caused by a, quote, lack of an ability to compromise. And in this hour of Forum, we're joined by Civil War historians to sort out myth from fact. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. We want to welcome first Edna Green Medford. She's professor of history at Howard University. And good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Jim Oakes, who's professor of history at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, author of The Scorpion Sting, Anti-Slavery and the Coming of the Civil War. Welcome, Jim Oakes.
Thank you.
And Stephanie Arduini is with us as well this morning. She is Director of Education and Programs at the American Civil War Museum. And welcome, Stephanie Arduini.
Thank you. Welcome.
Glad to have all of you aboard, and thank you for joining us this morning. Edna Green Medford, I'd like to begin with you, if I might, and just have your response to, General Kelly's remarks. We can talk about Robert E. Lee forthwith, but he's saying that Robert E. Lee was a man who fought for the state, and there was a lack of compromise that led to the Civil War.
Well, first of all, yes, Lee did fight for his state, but there were many Virginians, many other Southerners who loved their states as well, but fought for the Union. And so to suggest that he's honorable because states meant more to people than the nation did at that time, it's just ludicrous.
Well, it's also ludicrous to many historians that he seemed to not acknowledge the role of slavery. And the fact is, there's a high percentage, according to polls, of many Americans who think states' rights had much more to do with the Civil War than slavery.
Right, and he certainly does marginalize the importance of slavery to the war. I mean, anyone who knows anything about the history of that era know that it was about the expansion of slavery that led to these issues to begin with. And so differences over the expansion of slavery led to secession, and then secession led to the war.
Can you separate?
No way.
I'm sorry, I just wondered.
You cannot separate.
States' rights from slavery?
Slavery is at the core. Slavery is at the core of everything. And so if they're fighting for states' rights, they're fighting for the rights of the state to hold 4 million people enslaved.
And they're saying essentially the right to own black people is not a question of states' rights. I mean, when we go back to that time and that period and that era.
Well, the whole idea is that these states have the right to control their domestic institutions. That's what they're saying. And slavery is at the center of that. It's more important to them economically than anything else. More important to them socially, because slavery controls everything during that period.
And Jim Oakes pretty much agree with what you're hearing?
To say that states were more important than the nation at that period, well, somebody forgot to tell that to Abraham Lincoln, who thought that the Union was more important and was worth going to war to preserve, as well as the 1 million-plus Northern volunteers who joined the Union Army to preserve the Union against a struggle to make slavery the centerpiece of a nation like the likes of which had never existed in the history of the world, a nation created for the purpose of protecting and perpetuating slavery.
I'm also struck, though, by General Kelly saying that there were an inability to compromise. Actually, you mentioned President Lincoln. President Lincoln, it turns out, included a proposal, a constitutional amendment that would have retained slavery.
Well, I don't think that's correct, actually. I think that's a mistake to say that. First of all, it wasn't his proposal. It was actually the Corwin Amendment, as it's called, was in the 1860 Republican Party platform. It's not a compromise. It's just a statement that everybody, virtually everybody from the Constitutional Convention of 1787 until 1860 believed, which was that the federal government did not have the constitutional power to abolish slavery in a state. Lincoln said that, but so did William Lloyd Garrison, and so did Thaddeus Stevens, and so did radical abolitionists. Everybody understood that, and it's not really a meaningful compromise proposal in that sense, and it wasn't his proposal anyway.
I'm sorry, but Daniel Crofts did a book called Lincoln and the Politics of Slavery, and he said that Congress supported, and so did President Lincoln, the idea that, there should be a constitutional amendment that would have retained slavery.
No, it would have prevented the federal government from directly abolishing slavery in a state. But everybody already agreed that the federal government didn't have the power to abolish slavery in the state. In fact, the reason that proposal didn't go anywhere is because the secessionists said, we already know that. That's not the problem. The problem isn't that the federal government is going to abolish slavery in the state. It's going to abolish slavery in the territories. It's going to stop enforcing the fugitive slave law. It's going to abolish slavery in Washington, D.C. It's going to suppress slavery on the high seas. It's going to do everything it can to attack slavery wherever it could, but not in the states, because everybody already agreed that the Constitution didn't allow the federal government to abolish slavery in the states, and it never did.
Well, it was all in the secessionist papers, I believe, but also, and I'd like to just get your sense of illumination on this fact, there was there not a sense of not only a panic about secession over equal rights for slaves, that there would be extensive rights given to slaves, and that would, in fact, supplant the, white supremacy.
Well, the fugitive slave controversy, which was also a big part of what's going on in the crisis of the 1850s, and all the secessionists are talking about, we can't get our fugitive slaves, they hate slavery, and like, it's all, the entire controversy over fugitive slaves, which raged during the 1850s, was based on the attempts by northern states to pass a series of personal liberty laws, they did, that presupposed that any black person coming into that state or in that state was a citizen and therefore entitled to the privileges and immunities of citizenship, which includes due process rights, habeas corpus, and the like. So those are the rights that people were talking about. And the slaveholders were saying, no, they're just property, and we have a right of recaption to go into any northern state, any northern community, and take our property back. You can't be giving them rights like due process and the like.
Again, Jim Oakes, professor of history, graduate center, City University of New York. His book is called The Scorpion Sting. And Stephanie Iderwini is director of education and programs at the American Civil War Museum. And Stephanie Iderwini, what would compromise have meant at that time?
Compromise, it's really interesting because compromise at that point would have been compromise over the continued expansion and perpetuation of the institution of slavery. And as we hear conversation about compromise from scholarship, especially that comes out of scholarship that originated in the mid to late 20th century, that scholarship focused a lot on political compromise, but didn't often feature what was compromising on, imagining the humanity and the experiences of the people who were held in bondage in the institution of slavery.
There was a lot of, crisis going on around allowing slavery on the frontiers at that time, I believe. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. So in the mid-1800s, or the first half of the 1800s, the United States was expanding westward very rapidly, and only about 20 or 30 years before the American Civil War, cotton on plantations expanded and exploded in its strength and its power. One thing that we often hear a lot about slavery and its role in the cause of the Civil War is this myth that slavery itself would have died out naturally, it wasn't actually growing, which is absolutely false, since slavery as an institution was expanding and the enslaved population in the United States was expanding at the time of the Civil War. And the United States was the largest most powerful slave society in the world. So the idea of trying to reconcile freedom and those core ideals of the United States at the same time as holding, in 1860, 4 million people in bondage, spoke to this conflict at the core of who we identified ourselves as Americans and who was considered an American and at what right.
So let me ask you, Stephen Arduini, as someone who is concerned about the narrative of the Civil War and educating our young people as to what that correct narrative is, or correct in the sense of the facts, not necessarily in terms of biases. When we hear General Kelly talk about good people on both sides fighting for conscientious reasons, or when you hear that, or when he sort of echoes perhaps the president talking about knowledge of history being the necessity of seeing both sides, and really de-emphasizing slavery, what's your response?
I think it speaks to a misunderstood element of the process of history, is that history changes, it evolves, and that's normal, because as each generation grows and as our world around us grows and changes and evolves, the questions that we ask ourselves continue to change, and we go back to the source material to expand what we know about an event. Sometimes we're expanding that narrative, sometimes we're correcting that narrative. So when we hear this idea of both sides fighting honorably, sure, there are people who are individuals who are fighting for a variety of reasons, but as my colleagues here have said, that slavery is the single indispensable cause of the Civil War, and how we reconcile that with individual motivations is hard, and it's complex, and it doesn't fit easily into the idea of good people and bad people, or it doesn't fit in easily into the narrative of who we like to imagine ourselves to be as Americans, full of good, noble people and not bad people. So when it comes to educating youth, bringing in that idea of complexity and humanity and the idea that that actually is important and okay is something that's challenging, but I believe absolutely necessary in order to empower a future generation of American citizens.
So let me go back to you, if I may, Professor Medford, and Edna Greene Medford, again, is professor of history at Howard University. When General Kelly says, we shouldn't be making judgments by our own modern standards, does that make sense, especially since it's over, well over a century ago that we're talking about?
Well, I agree. We shouldn't be making judgments based on where we think we are today. But if we just look at what's happening with other people during that time period and we put Lee in that context, there are many people who are not giving up their country and fighting for their state. There are men in the Union Army who are fighting, who are from Virginia or from some of the other states, but are fighting for the Union because they understand that the Union is ultimate, that that needs to be preserved. And so the idea that General Lee gets a pass because he loved Virginia so much, it just does not hold water.
Well, let's talk about General Lee a bit with you. There's been a kind of hagiography of General Lee as a great strategist, which I don't think ties in, forgive me my throat, with actual history. I mean, in fact, there are those who say the South could have done a lot better without General Lee, that he just wasn't not only wasn't a good strategist, but when it came to Gettysburg, he made a lot of the wrong moves.
Well, you know, I know that there is disagreement about whether or not he was the great general that he's been given credit for. That is not my area of expertise, so I really don't want to comment on that, you know, except to say that he was pretty he seemed to do a very good job in many of those battles, enough so that a lot of men lost their lives on both sides. And so I don't know if the South would have done a better job. I just think that the fact that he is so revered just simply gives credence to the whole idea of the lost cause in the South. So it's all part and parcel of that.
Well, he was also, Jim Oakes, kind of presented as a genteel aristocrat who was opposed to slavery when, in fact, I believe he owned three slaves that belonged to his father-in-law. But that picture of him perhaps is not quite accurate.
No, it's not accurate. He believed that slavery was the proper condition for blacks, given the state of civilization they were in up to that time. He wasn't as extreme as some of the most extreme pro-slavery racists and radicals, but he was generally pro-slavery. And you know, as Professor Medford said, it just doesn't make any sense to detach his support for his state from his support for a nation that came into existence for the sole purpose of protecting and perpetuating slavery.
And what about Lee again as a strategist? I noticed that James McPherson, James McPherson said the South could have done a lot better essentially by not being as much on the offensive as they were, and that may have indeed lost a great deal more than could have been lost.
Well, I do think we've come a long way from the age of when people just thought Lee was the greatest strategist in the history of the military history of the United States. And there are enormous controversies among historians over whether or not a strictly defensive war would have served the South better. He attacks the North twice. Maybe he shouldn't have done that at all. He was a very aggressive military strategist. Maybe he spent too much time on Virginia when the war was really being won and lost in the West. All of those questions, it seems to me, are perfectly reasonable questions to ask from a strictly military history point of view. But one of the things I think that we need to do is separate out his qualities as a military strategist from the larger context in which he's operating. This is one of the reasons I saw on the other day in that interview where Kelly makes those remarks. It's prompted by a church in, I think, Alexandria, Virginia, that is planning to remove the plaques of both Robert E. Lee and George Washington. And I think the difference between those two is that a crucial difference is that Washington has a lot of enormous achievements to his name, not only as a military strategist, but as the first president, as a voice of moderation at the Constitutional Convention. He was really important for a multitude of very important reasons in U.S. history, whereas Robert E. Lee would be completely unknown to us as historians and as Americans, had it not been for the fact that he chose to side with the Confederates during the Civil War. He was offered by a Virginian who was in charge of the Union Army, Winfield Scott, a better general than Lee. He was offered the control of all the Union armies and turned it down in order to go with his state against his nation.
Well, in other words, I wonder if you agree with Yale historian David Blight, who said Lee was no compromiser. He chose treason. He was a Confederate nationalist, is what Blight says.
He was a Confederate nationalist.
Yeah, that's how Blight describes him. Let me go back to Stephanie Arduini. And Stephanie Arduini, what were the Northerners thinking at this time? Let me give you a quote from a 2013 Atlantic Monthly story by Tony Horowitz entitled 150 Years of Misunderstanding the Civil War. He writes, "Very few Northerners went to war seeking or anticipating the destruction of slavery. They fought for union, and the Emancipation Proclamation was a means to that end, a desperate measure to undermine the South and save a democratic nation that Lincoln called the last best hope on earth."
So I think that's absolutely right, is that Lincoln viewed the secession as something that was illegal and was calling, or what caused Virginia and the second wave of secession states to secede, was Lincoln's call for volunteers to help put down the uprising at Fort Sumter. And so that the idea was preserving the Union and helping to put down states in rebellion underlines the idea that this, for most people, was an idea of preserving the Union. However, I think it's also really interesting and important to change or to understand that the Emancipation Proclamation does change this as tactics and is also an expansion of the platform of the Republican Party that does speak to abolition. But the idea that the war for emancipation and abolition changes after the Emancipation Proclamation, so halfway through the war.
I wanted to actually bring up a editorial that appeared contemporaneously to the period we're talking about here in the New York Herald, urging Lincoln to compromise and do so to end what they described in that newspaper as the nation's Republican Party wanting to, quote, exterminate the white race in the South and not let the Negroes become free. And when we're talking about compromises, well, three-fifths of a person in the Constitution, slaves getting that fractional designation, was a compromise. There was a Northwest Ordinance that allows slaves new territory but kept the fugitive slave fugitive slave clause intact. There was a Missouri Compromise. In other words, there were a lot of compromises. And what I want to hear from you, our listeners, is what your view is of General Kelly's remarks, obviously, but what your view is of the Civil War and how it was taught to you or how you perceive it now, particularly when you try to separate the whole question, as many do, of states' rights from the question of slavery. And there's a lot to be said here about our friend Ken Burns' movie. And in fact, we're coming up on a break here, so I just want to maybe go to the historian for a moment. Edna Green Medford, Ken Burns has been criticized a good deal, and I think it's maybe appropriate criticism. Shelby Foote was in 1990 when Ken Burns did the Civil War movie, was saying there couldn't be compromise and things of that sort, that again presented Robert E. Lee as this courtly aristocrat. How much goes back really to that kind of view?
Well, you know, I think that we have struggled with this for a long, long time, and certainly much earlier than Ken Burns's documentary. It's the lost cause argument has been around for many, many decades. Well, for more than a century now, but I think that that's not going to change until there are more voices out there pushing back at the kinds of comments that are being made, especially now, especially in the last year or so, about the war. But this isn't something that just happened. This is what we've been struggling with as a nation for a long, long time. And as was said previously, it really is about how we identify ourselves as a nation. It's very difficult to look at the war as something that shouldn't have happened, would not have happened, had slavery not existed in the country. It's very difficult to see America as a land of opportunity and a place for freedom for all people, and then have to acknowledge that so many people were enslaved.
Well, let us hear from our listeners on that and the other things that we've brought up here. The old reconciliationist view of the Civil War is what we're talking about. That's pretty much represented by General Kelly. Men fighting for an honorable cause, fighting for their state rights, and not necessarily fighting to preserve slavery. How do you see it? We would like to hear from you, and we invite your calls. Our toll-free number is available to you right now. It's 866-733-6786. Join us and feel free to comment. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also let us know what's on your mind in the conjunction with myths about the American Civil War versus realities by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum, and you can also go to our Facebook page. Talking with historians Edna Green Medford, Jim Oakes, and also Director of Education and Programs at the American Civil War Museum, Stephanie Arduini. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the American Civil War, particularly in light of General Jim Kelly's remarks that were said recently about the causes of the Civil War, putting a great deal of weight on inability to compromise and also on states' rights, and Robert E. Lee being a man of conscience who was doing what he felt was best for the state he came from, Virginia. Edna Green Medford is with us. She's professor of history at Howard University, and Jim Oakes, also with us, professor of history at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and author of The Scorpion Sting, Anti-Slavery and the Coming of the Civil War. And Stephanie Arduini is also with us, Director of Education and Programs with the American Civil War Museum. And you're going to be with us in just a moment. In fact, let me read some comments that are coming in. There's a whole range of them. Let me give you some samplings here. Jeff writes, when I attended UC Berkeley back in the 70s, the concept that the Civil War was not due to slavery was taught in an upper division class I attended. It was attributed to a power struggle between the industrial North and the agricultural South. Can I hear from you on that, Jim Oakes?
That's the Beardian interpretation. That's the beginnings of what we're calling the Lost Cause interpretation of the Civil War. It's what you might call the anything but slavery explanation for the Civil War. It wasn't about anti-slavery in the North or pro-slavery in the South. It was an industrial society in the North versus agrarianism in the South. It's an erasure of slavery from the history of the Civil War. And can I also say that the Lost Cause interpretation has two halves. Erasing slavery from the origins of the Civil War means erasing slavery from secession, but it also means erasing anti-slavery from the history of the North. And I think we haven't yet gotten out of that. We still have historians saying that the North was not anti-slavery when, you know, in 1852, 50,000 people swarmed into the streets of Boston to prevent the rendition of a fugitive slave.
How do you deny the abolition movement? I mean, how do you erase that? It seems so...
Well, it's not just the abolition movement. The abolitionist movement had enormous influence in the North. You erase it by saying that abolitionists were widely despised in the South. Garrison was dragged through the streets of Boston. He was in 1837, but 15 years later, as I said, 50,000 people swarmed in to stop the rendition of a fugitive slave. The vote against the Fugitive Slave Act in the North by Northern congressmen was 2-1 against it. Right? 15 states passed personal liberty laws in the 1850s to try to thwart the Fugitive Slave Act. And in the secession conventions, one after another, they complained that you can't get a fugitive slave back from the North because the Northerners are so hostile to slavery. And I think we haven't yet gotten out of that second half of the Lost Cause mythology because we keep saying that the North wasn't interested in slavery. And the effect is to say the South seceded to protect slavery, but it was just a hysterical overreaction to a non-existent threat. And I think that's a very serious mistake. I don't think it's an accident that the Lincoln administration decided 10 weeks into the war not to return fugitive slaves to their owners when they come into states that were in rebellion against the Union. They had been saying they were going to do that for decades and decades and decades, and Lincoln said it in 1859 in the speech in Cincinnati. We are not going to return slaves if you secede from the Union. I think it's a really serious mistake, and I also think it's a mistake to say that unionism is not there's a unionism in the South. It's pro-slavery unionism, and the unionism that Lincoln and his party represented was anti-slavery unionism. Their conception of the Union ideally was a union without slavery. So I think it's a mistake to separate anti-slavery from unionism and say that the war was about union and not slavery, because their conception of the Union had anti-slavery built into it.
But you can separate slavery and state rights?
No, you can't separate slavery from states' rights. As Professor Medford said, the right, nobody goes to war for the abstract principle of states' rights. There has to be something that you want states to be able to do, and what they wanted states to be able to do was to enslave millions and millions of people and hold them as human property. That's the right they wanted as states to be able to continue to do.
All right, I want to read a couple more remarks. Rod writes, I'm not a supporter of the South, but I am surprised by the seemingly limited perspective of today's guest. Most of the Southern officers served honorably in the Mexican War. Were Lee and Stonewall Jackson slave owners? Were most of the non-commissioned soldiers who fought for the South drafted or slave owners? How many of the non-commissioned soldiers who fought for the North were draftees, and how many were not citizens, like recent immigrants? Stephanie Arduini, can I go to you on that?
I will allow my panel or fellow panelists to chime in on this also, but I would say that about a quarter of families in the Confederacy did own enslaved people, or at least one. And I think the challenging piece about this is...
And forgive me, as I said earlier, Lee owned slaves as well.
That's correct. I think what's also really challenging about this idea of that I hear frequently here at the museum is, well, my great-great-great-grandfather didn't own any slaves, and he served in the Confederacy, so that could not have been about slavery. But it's hard to unwrap the idea of individual owning of enslaved people with the idea that many people in the Confederacy were also renting enslaved people to work for various periods of terms and various capacities, and that the entire social structure and economy was built on the system of enslavement. So it's even if people didn't own enslaved people as their property, or if they only owned one or two, they're still owning people and still living in and benefiting from a society that is at its center revolving around slavery.
All right, we've got lots of callers. Let me get to as many of you as I can.
If I might add.
I'm sorry. This is Professor Medford. Go ahead, please.
Yes, yes. So I agree. It's not just about economics. It's also a social institution as well. And so every white person in the South benefits from slavery because their status is automatically elevated as a consequence of the institution. So they might actually be suffering economically because they're having to compete with the labor of enslaved people, but they are benefiting socially because just by virtue of being white, their status is elevated in the society.
And Robert writes, don't forget to mention that Kelly's description of, quote, fine people on both sides echoes the president's statement regarding Charlottesville. And let me go to our callers. Brian, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi there. Brian from Sacramento. I just wanted to point out that maybe it's good to emphasize separating the Confederate political leadership from many, certainly not all, but many of the ground soldiers for the Confederates, because many were drafted. Many were, working in poor rural farms. This was the biggest thing ever for an 18-year-old young man. And also there was peer pressure. For example, the Stanley that we know who found Livingston later in now Zimbabwe, he was in Charleston at the time. He was not even an American. He didn't join the Confederate Army. And later in his shop, he received a package that included a petticoat. So what it was is the community saying, hey, if you don't go, then you're pretty much a coward. And he ended up joining, and he was later captured as a POW and then repatriated into the Union Navy. So I just wanted to point out that there are many reasons why a young man would have joined the Confederate Army.
Yeah, Brian, I appreciate your pointing that out, and thank you for the call. We'll go right on to another caller. Joanne joins us next. Joanne, you're on.
Hi. Yes, I've always wanted to ask a historian this question, and one of the professors referred to it before. But in my very limited understanding of the war, I have studied the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, and what I saw was that people in the North were absolutely horrified at being required to return slaves to the South, and also were under penalty of imprisonment for doing so. And that, to me, therefore, the war is about states' rights. It's about the states' right to not return slaves to the South and to not participate in slavery when they had already decided they did not want to participate in slavery.
That's a good point, Joanne. And let me go to Jim Oakes on this.
That's a very important point. One of the reasons the states' rights argument is unpersuasive as an explanation for what the South was doing is because the Northerns, everybody was for states' rights in the sense that the federal government was much less powerful in those days than it is today. And the Northern states were, in fact, asserting their right to determine how fugitive slaves were to be treated when they came into their states. And they objected to the Southerners insisting that the federal government use its power to force the Southern version of rendition onto the states in the North. So the states' rights argument fails in large measure because the South was demanding the federal government force Northerners to participate in the slave system in a way that Northerners, many found offensive, exactly as the caller indicated.
And I thank the caller for joining us. And we have another caller joining us from Columbia, South Carolina. Selby, good morning.
Good morning. I moved to the South in middle school, and they had a specific South Carolina history class that pretty much just was a Civil War class, but never did the ideas of morality or anything come up, and it was very much pro-South, not really pro-slavery, and then there would be, we would have to read lots of books from slaves' perspectives that were not necessarily negative. I remember reading Clover, and lots of kids reenacted in the, things on the weekend, and me not being from the South, even though I'm mostly Native American heritage and from the West, was called a Yankee quite regularly, and I never really understood why it was so emphasized. That was quite a few years ago, but I'm sure it's still very much part of the way of the South to learn very much about it, where I'm sure the rest of the country barely touches on it.
I thank you for that. And let me go to Stephanie Arduini again. I mean, there is perhaps, they used to say that the Revolutionary War in England was taught as the colonial revolt against the British, whereas here it's called the Revolutionary War. I mean, there are different interpretations regionally of the Civil War that continue, I presume, and more chauvinism and nationalism in the South.
Absolutely. I'm originally from Michigan and attended school in Michigan. And before I moved to Richmond to take this job, I was in Seattle. And in announcing this to my friends that I was going to go work at a museum about the Civil War, they said, really, that's a thing? That's still a thing? Isn't this over? And it's just this disconnect that I think does vary by region, both in how things are taught, what states choose to emphasize based on their standards and curriculums, but also just based on the culture and the impact of the Civil War and its legacies on these regional cultures. One reason I think that the Civil War in particular is so contentious, especially around primarily Southern communities who are having these conversations about what to do with Confederate symbols, like Confederate battle flags and monuments, is that the idea of the Civil War and the Confederacy has for so long been so closely tied to a large portion of that mainstream white Southern identity, and in other places, not even white Southern identity, but just Southern identity, that to poke holes or challenge the narrative of the Civil War and of the Confederacy, of its causes and its legacies, also threatens people's conceptions of their own identity, which can be very hard to process and elicit a lot of reactions that come from a very emotional place and not necessarily a place of logic at first.
And let me say that emotional place was, if anything, even cemented to a much further degree, or exacerbated, I should say, by Reconstruction and by the North imposing its will on the South and asking for reparations even. Here's a listener, Joanne, who writes, I'm currently reading a book called Apostles of Disunion by Charles B. Dew, a Southerner, who set out to learn once and for all which was the cause of the Civil War, states' rights or slavery. From 1860 to 1861, state-appointed commissioners were sent out by the South to convince uncommitted slave states to forge a Confederacy. The book includes the verbatim speeches made by the commissioners, literally all to whom used the fear over losing slavery as the underlying reason for the Confederacy. And that brings up, and let me go back to you, Edna Green Medford, Edna Green Medford's professor of history at Howard University. There were compromises. Again, going back to General Kelly's remark about no compromises, there were compromises that were made over what states would have slavery and didn't have slavery.
Absolutely. And you know, there were compromises from the beginning of the nation. I mean, it's a compromise when you indicate that the Northwest Territory is going to be free of slavery, although it wasn't. They were still able to bring enslaved people in against the law. There was a compromise with the writing of the Constitution, because there are clauses there that deal with slavery. There are compromises with the Missouri Compromise. So it goes right on through the early history of the nation. So how one can say there were no compromises, but it gets to the point where how do you continue to compromise over the issue of the enslavement of human beings? Lincoln had it right when he said that slavery prevented the nation from being able to claim that it was a place of freedom and equality for all people. So it really was a blight on the integrity of the nation, on the whole image of the nation. What I find interesting, though, about the lost cause argument, one would expect that to be a Southern sentiment, perhaps. But what's interesting is, over the years, Northerners have embraced that attitude as well. Not all, of course, but it seems to become to have become much more prevalent in certain areas of the North as well. And so one wonders how we got to this point where it's almost seen as an affront to the South to argue that slavery was the issue in the war, and we don't want to offend the sensibilities of Southerners.
There were a number of polls, as I said earlier, around the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. There was a big Roper poll on public opinion, Pew Research. Just go down the list here, CNN and so forth. Most of them, not all of them, but most of them, a great majority of them said that, and this included the North, of course, that Americans believed And I suppose what's being characterized here as a lost cause, states' rights and the Confederacy and the South shall live on and all the rest of it. Here's a comment about General Kelly's remarks from Dan, who writes, General Kelly shows admiration for a traitor. It's troubling, the depths of treachery being exposed through the words and actions of this administration. To hear these words come from a retired Marine Corps general, one has to wonder how many more like him are on active duty. And here's a caller who wants to talk about Robert E. Lee. Thomas, join us. You're on.
Yeah, hi. I think the answer to the question of why this is coming up now is the unspoken elephant in the room that we had a pretty darn good African-American president. And that really shook up a lot of these old prejudices and slanted views of why the Civil War was fought. But my question that I called in about was, there was an email going around last summer that said that Robert E. Lee himself was against building monuments to Southern generals because it would prevent the healing that needed to go on, and it would just keep the old wounds open. And he himself was against these monuments. Do you guys, any of your experts, know about that?
Well, I'll throw the question out to whomever wants to step up here, Jim Oakes or Edna Green Medford or Stephanie Arduini.
I don't know the exact answer to that question, but it's consistent with one of the points that historians made over the summer when the Confederate monuments controversy erupted, that those monuments were not constructed in the immediate aftermath of the war, but they were constructed at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century at the height of the Jim Crow era, and reflected a very different sensibility from the one that prevailed in the immediate aftermath of the war.
More of your calls. Let's get Dave on next. Dave, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yeah, hey, thank you. Dave from Mountain View. Great comment just now, by the way. I really enjoyed that. I just wanted to mention that I go back and forth on General Kelly, primarily because, you know, with so much chaos going on, it seems like at first it felt like he was adding a sense of stability there. But then, you know, he just seems like such a curmudgeon, and he definitely seems like he misses the good old days. So I don't know, but what the comment I wanted to bring up was that, you know, we seem to be missing or not talking about the fact that he actually comes from the military, where you believe in honor and loyalty and, you know, commitment without questioning. And I haven't really heard anybody comment about this, about the fact that since, you know, he's from the South and they definitely believed in their kind of way of life. And so when this, you know, issue comes up where you might go fight, you're probably going to be loyal to the military, or at least to that the Southern military, and fight without question. And I kind of feel like if that's your responsibility to fight and without question, then you can still do that honorably. And I think that we, coming from his background in the military, you know, are we really teaching our soldiers to question everything? I don't think so. I think you have to, you know, at some point, if you join the military, you turn over your you know, you turn over that questioning and you say, okay, I believe in my country and my military. I'm going to go fight and not question everything.
Well, Dave, you raise an important point. Particularly, General Kelly came under a good deal of criticism for what seemed to be a division that he was making between those in the military and those who were civilians. I'm going to read some comments that sort of dovetail with this. A number of listeners weighing in here. And Jay writes, it's appalling that the Confederacy, its soldiers and states' rights have not been demonized. The losing side deserves no honor, only disgust. We move forward together as a nation, learning from the evils of slavery. We don't look down on the South, just the Confederacy and the soldiers, flags, statues, etc. You don't see Hitler statues in Germany. Chris writes, easy to believe Lincoln and other Northern leaders truly wanted to preserve the Union, but I find it difficult to believe that truly motivated the thousands of common men from the North to leave their farms and homes, to put their lives at risk, fighting other men that lived in a different society hundreds of miles away. What else motivated them? Good question. Stephanie Arduini?
Well, I think portion of what motivated some soldiers who fought for the Confederacy was that there was a draft and that had a higher proportion of conscription in the Confederacy than in the North. But I think also the picture that we tend to paint when talking about the Confederacy and Confederate service is that the idea that all people in the Confederacy were supportive of the Confederacy, and it ignores examples of people who deserted the Confederate Army or the Unionists, many of whom, as was mentioned previously, especially at the outset of war, were for preservation of the Union in order to preserve the institution of slavery. But here in Richmond, we have somebody who also had an abolitionist motivation to be a Unionist by the name of Elizabeth Van Loo, who worked as a spy for the U.S. military and for Ulysses S. Grant. So I think it's hard to say what motivated individual soldiers, and because there's so much more about why individuals went to war, why what they chose to do when put in those places. But ultimately, also, they were serving for the Confederate government, which was a government founded on the perpetuation and expansion of slavery.
Was there, do you think, Stephanie Arduini, some kind of concerted effort to change the way the Civil War has been taught to diminish the role of slavery? And if so, and it seems to be implied here in this conversation we've been having, how did that happen, and do we know when it happened?
So after the Civil War, when these monuments started to go up, especially to Confederate soldiers just in general or to specific individuals, at the same time, there was this larger idea of how was the Confederacy trying to, how were ex-Confederates trying to reimagine their place in the United States, in history? How were they trying to reconcile a defeat with their own identity? And a lot of this comes out of the place of, well, we know slavery's gone, emancipation happened, but it was trying to give honor to the fact that folks were serving and de-vilify the fact that they did go to war, vindicate is probably a better word, that they did go to war to preserve slavery, and at the same time try to put them in the position or paint them in the way of being American heroes or worthy of respect. So at the same time the statues are going up, there are a lot of people who are also trying to expand this idea of Confederate memory in other places, including in textbooks and curriculums, in terms of popular culture. So a lot of monuments are going up in the early 20th century, but that's at the same time as D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. In 1939, Gone with the Wind comes, made from Margaret Mitchell's book. So there's a lot of this idea of repainting the view of Southern history as a place of good, valuable, full of valor and honor, which are the same values that people use to describe Robert E. Lee. And one reason why he is so widely honored is because he is held as the prime example of that kind of Southern honor and valor. So as women in particular, women's groups were behind a lot of the monument building efforts, especially here in Richmond. And those same women were also organizing themselves in really impressive ways to continue this lost cause narrative and embed it into things like curriculums and culture.
Well, here's Jed who writes, I grew up in Richmond, class of 98, and I vividly still remember answering a multiple choice question on a test about the reason for the Civil War. Slavery was an option, but not the correct one. Misrepresentation was correct on that test. Seems, he writes, that many Southerners didn't see any plausible means to sustain their economy without the institution of slavery. Of course, in any case of injustice, the oppressor should be expected to sacrifice. But what other options were there for white Southerners outside of slavery to sustain themselves? And we're getting a lot of these responses that have to do with how people were educated when they were younger on this question. Another listener writes, I was taught that expansion of slavery beyond the South was the driving factor of the Civil War. It was never particularly, the North might have tolerated it or turned a blind eye up until the war, since they benefited too from cheap agricultural output, tobacco and cotton for their mills. Timothy writes, I grew up in the South in Georgia, and one would hear the revisionist arguments from time to time from peers. It was never particularly taught in my high school, however. We had field trips where we worked cotton fields to see what it was like. We were spared the utter brutality of it, but they tried to make horror ring out. Psychologically, perhaps that approach did backfire and lead some kids to retrench to protect their Southern identity. And here's David, who says, I believe there's a strong argument for the idea that Lincoln should have let the South go. Could you imagine how much better we would be without southern red states? All right, let me go to more calls here. Let's go to Redwood City. Greg, you're on the air.
Good morning. I just want to say, you know, you guys are having a very intellectual conversation that I'm deeply appreciate. But as an African-American, it's so far away from where this touches my heart. You know, I think that, you know, the conversation has been lost on how, you know, people, minorities in this country have suffered and are still trying to heal from all of this. And it's, you know, it's a very intellectual conversation. But for a lot of people in this country, this is so incredibly painful to have to walk under these monuments. And I think that's lost in this conversation.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, and I thank you for that. There is obviously a great deal of pain that's associated in suffering with slavery. And we have time maybe for one more call, and that's you, Jason. Thank you for waiting. You're on.
Hey, Michael, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that in regards to demonization of the South, I don't think that the South can be demonized enough because slavery was aspirational. Even if you didn't own a slave, you aspired to own one. And they're all complicit in that.
Well, I suppose, and Jim Oakes, let's get your wisdom on this. There were people in the South who were opposed to slavery and who thought it was a terrible institution.
Yeah, but the anti-slavery force sentiment in the South did decline as the cotton economy grew. I do think, however, that the point that's been made earlier that we need to realize that there was widespread opposition to secession in the South. There were huge pockets of unionism in the South that were viciously and violently repressed by the Confederacy. But there's one important point that we tend to lose. 40% of the Southerners were African-American, and they were not Confederates.
Important note to end on. Thank you, Jim Oakes. Thank you, Edna Green Medford. Thank you, Stephanie Arduini. And thanks to you, our listeners. Another hour up ahead, we're going to talk to the authors of a book on human creativity remaking the world. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.